How and at what point in your life did you become involved in social enterprise?
Well, I was involved in social enterprise long before it was called social enterprise. When did the term, from memory, I would say in the mid-1990s. But to trade, I am a community worker, and I think social enterprise, the ideal model of it, is when the social enterprise is a community enterprise. I think the model is perfectly suited for it serving a particular community owned by the people who live there. And so I was involved in that activity for many, many. I went to Wester Hales in particular in 1976, and I worked there for 14 years, setting up community enterprises of various kinds. So I was no stranger to. And when I was in Wester Hales, we set up lots of trading businesses, which the community owned. We set up the Wester Hales Land and Property Trust, which still trades and owns a lot of property. And I was without employment in 1999, and with a few other people, I set up Senscot, and that was explicitly to connect up social entrepreneurs. We realised that across Scotland there were any number of people like myself setting things up in communities, and that their work would be more effective if they were joined up, told each other what they were doing. So I sent out a letter to 10 people, and they sent it to 10 people. That was the theory. And within months, we had a network of hundreds. And that network is now probably about 4,500.
Wow. That's very.
So, when did I first get involved in social? I've been involved in it 40 years, more than that. But it became known as social, it started to be called social enterprise, I would say the mid 1990s. Senscot dates from 1999. And since then, it's made tremendous advances. And the term is now, I wouldn't say the general public would understand what it meant, they'd be puzzled. The third sector has been transformed by it, and it's beginning to work its way into the mainstream. Ask me another.
Well, I was really interested to hear maybe a bit more about your time in Wester Hales and, those very early days. I mean, what was it like in Wester Hales at that time?
Well, they built a housing estate without any of the social facilities which people need to have a normal life. They built plentiful car parks, but nobody had cars. And there weren't buildings that could be used for the community. The most dramatic thing we did was we learnt the skill of putting up buildings. There were surplus classroom units in schools across the Lothian region and elsewhere. And we developed the skill of dismantling them and re-erecting them in Wester Hales. And I think in the day we had, I think, a dozen, 14 transportable classroom units operating as community bases. So my job, I worked then for the Lothian region. My job was to help get alongside the local people and help them create the missing facilities in the area. That was very, very successful, and there was a real appetite among people to get involved, to do for themselves. inevitably, the dynamic was adversarial. It was us, the community's good, the council, boo, bad. So we played that dynamic quite consciously. The council had done everything wrong to make this place inadequate. We are going to do something about that, in spite of them. Mm-hmm. Now, to a large extent, it was perfectly true. These remote local government officers, all building little empires, didn't really care about the community, how it got on with things. One of the problems was that Wester Hales, as we knew it, in terms of the various departments of the region and district and central government, I think it worked out it was 32 different names it had. The social work department divided it into West End, blah, 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 blah. The planning department divided it into blah, blah, blah. The transport, blah, blah, blah. So, but we said, no, this is Wester Hales, that road. And we made a map, a plan, which contained everybody's house. And we sealed the local identity. 15 years, 20 years later, when they went to dismantle it, the local government, which they did quite deliberately, they went back to blurring it all again. It was West Edinburgh. It was this, you know, Wester Hales was wiped out as a name. So anyway, Wester Hales, you said to me, what was it like? It was very, I really, really enjoyed it. Another important breakthrough, the buildings was an important breakthrough. I mean, we simply went to the Manpower Services Commission, it's a job creation from the government. In those days, before all these big national private sector companies that run them now, there was a local organisation, Wester Hales organisation, that ran the job creation scheme. Now, over 15 years, we knew every family involved. And if you go 15 years, that's a full generation. So we knew their dad, a lot of them. So these were local people employing local people to do local jobs. They had a tremendous social capital benefit in terms of a feeling of cohesion. That was destroyed. That was taken over by Reed Consulting, which is a national company. So the job creation enabled us to get buildings. The buildings was a huge thing. People said to me, where did you get the budget? Well, there wasn't a budget. Building was put up on Murrayburn, the green grass in the middle of Murrayburn Place. But what about the money to run? Well, there wasn't any money. And people came out of the houses and went in, and the electricity got cut off sometimes, so you got it back on again. And the roof leaked. But there was an amazing community activity around these buildings. And then we set up the neighbourhood strategy. We divided the whole area into 22 neighbourhoods, and they all each had a council. Excuse me, I've got a cough. The neighbourhood councils. That was a very successful. I should get written up. So, alongside that, I got more and more interested in trading. So, the local chip shop was going bankrupt, so we took it over. And then we opened another chip shop. Then we opened a hairdresser shop. Then, so all over the place were these wee trading enterprises. It was too centralised. If I was doing it again, I would have it less centrally controlled. So that gave me a flavour for the power you got when you have your own money. So when we spoke with the local authority about doing something, they said no. We just said, well, we'll do it anyway. What do you mean you'll do it anyway? Well, we'll just do it. How can you just do it? You've not got a budget for it. I don't know, We'll take the money from the... So in the Western Hills Community Workshop, which is all knocked down now, at one time there were 30 to 40 organisations there, headquartered there. If one ran out of money, you just went next door, the printer won't print the Sentinel this month. We can't pay this, £1,200. Hang on a minute, have you got £1,200 there now? Well, I've got £1,200, but I need it by... Because that's when my payroll... So you just sort of... It was totally informal. Nobody signed a paper to say, I owe you... No, it was just, right... And everybody... So we had our own... You could almost say we had our own economy. And there was a general acceptance that... I mean, you had to pay it back, otherwise the whole thing tumbles down. Everyone knew that.
And can I just ask, was this people who had previously been unemployed? I mean, what kind of age of people were, you know, coming in and getting involved in the community?
Well, if you're a normal person with a normal job, you couldn't. You had to go to work. And the Western Hills Community Workshop, which was a series of huts... in a big square with an adventure playground in the middle. The adventure playground was inspirational, really. Having children in the middle of it playing and falling and crying and come on, that was inspirational because it somehow put a seal of approval on everything to have children there. And you knew each other's kids anyway. So the workshop opened when office hours, and in the heart of it was a cafe, the Venture Cafe, and that became a hub for the whole area. Whether or not cafes make money, they've got a tremendous social benefit effect. And so all these different organisations, the cafe, the adventure playground, that became a hub of community activity. Now, local government officers presiding over their department, arriving there, knew that we were not subject to local government culture. We had our own culture, and quite soon we had our own economy, as I said. So if somebody wanted to do something, you didn't ask for a grant to take kids to North Berwick for the day, but they want a business plan for. So you just said, right, how much is that going to cost? £300, right, hire a van, let's just do that. And once people get that feeling of, we can do what we want here if we organise. So, I was trying to say, we're trying to get on to social enterprise, right. So the idea that you traded for an overarching social purpose, that your trading was a means to an end, was not new to me at all. So when I picked up the term social enterprise, I thought to myself, yeah, I think that's going to come. In that way, that was insightful. And Senscott started, do you want to talk more about Wester Hills?
Well, maybe the kind of last thing I'd like to touch on in that area was, did you feel like you were very much embedded in Wester Hills, or were you looking at what other people were doing in Strathclyde? Or?
No, we were looking back, we were over-embedded. I'm going to close those doors, I'm not warm enough. If you need the loo, that's it there.
Okay.
From your perspective, I presume you're an academic person, are you, Gillian? Yes.
For my sins, yes.
Sorry?
Yes.
Yes. Well, I was I felt antipathy towards academe. I don't feel that now. Whether I felt intimidated, I don't know. But I felt they used a language which was purposely unapproachable by normal people. And I thought they were too divorced from reality. So my influence in Wester Hills was probably too much. And I made a kind of fairly deliberate, well, keep away from. But not only that, we kept away from other people doing the same thing, which was a big mistake. Now, Sendscott's job is connecting people up nationally into all sorts of things. 20 years ago, I wouldn't have agreed to talk to you. What's the fucking point in that? Now I do see the point in that. We don't have to invent everything again for the next, you know. Some of it can be kept and learnt from. So we were far too embedded in Wester Hales. When we were invited to visit another community, which we never went, but would be hostile. Why would it be hostile? Now I would do it differently in that respect. I'd be making bonds, links, all across Scotland and further. So that was an insightful question.
And do you think, kind of looking back, do you think the work you were doing, the kinds of jobs you mentioned, kind of chip shops and hairdressers, were those kind of services, do you think they would have only worked in Wester Hales? Do you think every community needed to look at what they needed? Or, you know, what, you know, how did you negotiate what people in the community wanted and what got done?
Well, my answer to that is quite, you see, there's a great lack of middle class skills. You needed to find a surveyor who was willing to give his time for nothing, his skill, his understanding, and an architect. We had actually an architectural practice, a branch practice of a firm in Edinburgh, and several architects trained in the Wester Hills Architectural Unit. So what I'm trying to say is that there aren't architects living in Wester Hills. So when you got, I sort of went off, earlier on you said, who were these people? And I didn't answer that properly. They're people who are collecting unemployment benefit or sickness benefit, or for whatever reason, I mean, it could be a single mother with a disabled child living in the high flats. She's probably got enough money just to live and nothing to do with her time. So she'd arrive with a blind child, and after sitting through 5 meetings without saying a word, a year later as the secretary of the group. That'd be a typical anecdote. But you have a huge lack of middle class skills that you and I have, take for granted. So they couldn't brief an architect or an accountant or a lawyer. Didn't have the confidence in the main. So the Wester Hills Community Workshop provided a core of middle class skills. Now, how would they decide, how would the people that live there decide on what businesses could work? What businesses would pay? And whether they would pay or not, the biggest determinant is probably who you've got running them. So how was it decided the various, I don't remember everything we did. It would not be a spontaneous bottom-up. Mind you, having said that, quite early on we started developing workshop units. I think we ended up with about 50 various sites. Now into the workshop units came some local people. This woman's an upholsteress, and she employs 2 upholsterers. She took a unit. But lots of the tenants were from outside the area as well. Just happened that they took a unit there. I don't think that you can depend on, it's not as if there's a lot of entrepreneurial flair waiting to get a unit, there isn't. Now that I'm involved with promoting social entrepreneurialism or social enterprise, we know we've got to start in schools, and we do now. The Social Enterprise Academy, is the work in schools is very impressive. You've got very young primary school children running a wee trading enterprise. That's learning. Everyone in my family, when I was at a family gathering, 50 people in the room, they were all talking about business. Every one of my family had a chip shop or a restaurant or an ice cream shop. The culture of my childhood was entrepreneurial. People would be saying, you know where there's a gap for a chip shop? The corner of Annandale Street, so-and-so Street. No, blah, blah. So these were people who were instinctively looking round for opportunities to make money. Now I think I blended that, personally, I blended that with the other side, of the social community side. And there you end up with a social entrepreneur. So where were we? You bring us back to where you want to go.
So I think that's given me a really good idea of, you know, where you started out. And then you mentioned you had a period of, you were unemployed at the end of the 1990s. Yeah. Why did that job change, or you know, what happened to, were you made redundant or?
Right, that's an important question, that. So a lot of people, I mean, how could you possibly work for the Lothian region? Because you're fundamentally, in your attitude, you're anarchistic. I resigned because a very supportive boss that I had that understood. I got all lessons in that. So now I'm unemployed, but I'd just set up the Western Hills Land and Property Trust, which was doing quite big deals. So for at least a year, I was paid by that. And then it got so big I needed a full-time chief executive, so it drifted away. So, 14 years from 1976, 90, around about 1990-ish, I cut loose from that. I was still getting a wee job with them or a job with them. And so I was technically a consultant from 1990 to 1999, where I did lots of one-off jobs.
And were they still based in Edinburgh, or were they across Scotland, the one-off?
I lived in Edinburgh. I lived in Stockbridge all during that time. The system put the stink in for me. I was seen as uncontrollable, wild man. It's amazing how reputations, but it didn't bother me that. I wasn't looking for work from the system. So I did lots of things I quite enjoyed doing, but there was no security. So I thought, right, I need to set up something that will pay me a wage. Then all my efforts will be to get resources into it. Now what does it need to be? And I conceived of Senscot, which was spot on really, which still pays me. I mean, I'm still employed by that. So what's your question, sorry?
And so let's talk about the start of Senscot then. You know, you mentioned you saw it as a wee kind of gap in the market almost. What was that gap that you were trying to fill with Senscot?
Right, so you're unemployed and you understand a bit about the system, how money, where is money out there, who's got money out there. You've got the lottery, huge resource for our sector. Who controls that? Is that the government? Not really, but sort of. And so who would give us some money to get started up? No one. So for Senscott, for the first 6 months, I didn't get a penny. Rodney Stairs, that wrote that, he had a wee room in a building in Manor Place, and the room next door to him became vacant, and I took it. And he found Gulbenkian would give us a couple of grand. I think we got 5 grand from Gulbenkian. And then we found 5 grand somewhere. So year one, I think I earned nothing for 6 months, and then maybe a grand a month. Year two, same. Year three, I got a salary. No employees yet, part-time on the IT stuff. But just as I go, you're unemployed, where does money come from? What would they be wanting to fund? But most importantly, what do you want to do? Lawrence, what do you want to do? Well, I like the whole idea of social enterprise. In your lifetime, the biggest change has been the dominance of neoliberalism, the American way of life. Everyone is motivated. All change is driven by money. No. Let's wheel it back, the pendulum, a bit the other way. The human being is motivated by other than that. There's an equally strong impulse in people for community, equally strong to greed. So let us be quite explicit. Social enterprise are trading enterprises for the common good. We'll be quite clear about that. We're not shy in any way. So I was and am captured by the basic ethic of social enterprise. That's why I got so vehement about the code. The asset lock is paramount. That's what takes it out of the private sector and into another sector. You can have all sorts of other hybrid models. Of course you can, and that's wonderful. But it's not a social enterprise. I say a social enterprise is asset locked. You cannot take dividends. You can't pay dividends. And if it winds up, it's got to be any assets left have to pass to our sector. So anyway, What was the gap I was trying to fill? First gap I was trying to fill was in my income, obviously. But designing in my mind, right, supposing we set up something that connects up people like yourself all over the place, and through a weekly bulletin, create the fantasy of there being a massive network of us who believe in these things, who do these things, and who recognize core values in each other. Let us just continuously replay. Let's describe this fantasy culture. It does exist, but it's more fragmented than we will pretend it is. And so that's what we did. And it was very, very popular, and people... So, Senscott has essentially got three objectives. The networks is probably a fourth one. It connects people up. There's another one which I forget. And the third one was, we'll create. We'll listen to what people are saying, and we'll help create with other people the infrastructural gaps. So what does social enterprise need in terms of an infrastructure to thrive? It'll need this, it'll need this. And so we systematically set about making these things happen. And Senscott's unusual, and I think very effective philosophy is, we'll not seek to own any of these things. We'll not seek to have an empire that's powerful. We'll avoid that. We'll avoid being powerful, because then you don't make enemies. And we've been very effective. Next week there's the launch of SCRT, the Scottish Community Reinvestment Trust, which will try to, it's a new intermediary to help build the financial infrastructure of our sector. But SenseCorp will be, a year from now, will be nowhere near that. It will be a, it is, it's a brand new skill, membership owned. And so that's the way we operate, is we gather people together. It's been 2 years in the making, SCRT. Gather the right people together, have meetings, evolve the idea together, collectively, try and bring in an appropriate CEO. Pauline Hinchin's going to run this one for the beginning. And then cast it adrift. Well, off you go. Now, some of these things that we've set up, you get them facing the right way, and then you steer, but some of them will wander off into swamps.
I suppose a little bit more about how you kind of practically went about gathering people up in order to build this the network that you did through SenseCorp. I mean, was there any particular area that was very enthusiastic? You know, were people in the Highlands, you know, the first to come on board, or, you know, which areas of Scotland thought got it right away? Or,
well, we started off with a kind of having meetings. So in the central belt, Glasgow, Edinburgh, that's always. And so what would the tenor of these meetings be? Probably a speaker, 30 people assorted. I wasn't happy with the way that was developing. I knew there needs to be face-to-face meeting. You're not going to get away with writing a bulletin, you know. There has to be, it's the relationship that makes things happen. So the meeting end became a much more light touch, helping to foster regional gatherings of people. We called them social enterprise networks. Now that's bubbling. Even more energetic are the thematic networks. I was reading yesterday that the creative network, the arts one's got 80 members, the sports one's got more than that. So, people in the sports field can see that social enterprise trading could be a means for them to become self-sufficient. As we move away from a grants culture, similarly arts. And there are two other, health's another one. So there are four altogether. I don't know whether they're written down there. Doesn't matter anyway. So the meetings became regional SENS, of which there are about 20, and thematic SENS. That, in my opinion, it should float off and become another separate organisation. But Aidan, who runs it, says, well, how are we going to get your salary? Because all the money we get is for the sense. Government pays us to do that. Nobody will pay anything to produce a bulletin because it's marginally disruptive, the bulletin. It tends to be critical of government, that's sometimes. So, my pure image of SenseCorp, it wouldn't have anything. It would just be a bulletin, set things up, move on to the next thing. What's next? Because that's no security in that, our trustees say to me. I said, well, who wants security? I said, what we're here for is to build something secure. So, over the years, the past decade, we've helped create a series So I would argue that when SCRT is up and away and it'll prosper or it won't, depends on all sorts of new factors. My instinctive mode is to be right. I'm alert. I'm optimistic. What does the sector need now? What should we be doing now? What new thing do we need? Do we need to bring people together? Do we need to disperse people? So, we have a bulletin that connects people, that promotes a culture, and we respond by setting things up. That's my understanding of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And in your mind, has the kinds of activities that social enterprise does, has that changed over time? You know, have people become interested in using social enterprise for different kinds of purposes? You know, how has that changed, you know, during the course of your work?
Well, this is a difficult subject for me in a way. I think that the central core of social enterprise, we will use all the benefits of the business culture for the purpose of social justice and looking after our planet. That has the potential so that the East Coast Line, railway line, shouldn't be run by Virgin and Stagecoach. It should be a social enterprise for the public good. Now, I think that has an applicability to a whole range of societal functions. Looking after old people, looking after tiny wee people, should all be social purpose ventures. Doesn't make them less efficient, but we'll have a humanity running through them. The overarching purpose here is not to pay dividends to investors, it's to look after children or look after old folk. So there's no tension between how much you give them to eat and your profit. Now, I see that being applicable all across society. My background, though, as an Italian cafe owner, it's not universal, it doesn't apply to everything. There are certain human functions. It's better if a single trader or a self-employed person does them. It's just instinctively better. It's a more appropriate way to do it. So, if I was setting up the Senscott Cafe, like Earthy at Cannon Mills, I would get someone in who I've watched and I like the way they operate, and I'd discuss values with them. I'd say, look, what is it you're in this for? Right, okay. Would it be compatible with you if we did that? Right, you run the cafe. At the end of the year, did you make any profit? Right, can you redistribute some of it? So, but you asked a different question. Over the last decade, has there been a shift in the sorts of things that social enterprises are taking on? See, every day through the email, we have a common email at Senscott. I'll receive notice of something that started up. A wee partnership has developed in Arran between them, and they're going to do that. Can we get them any help? Well, we could get help from him, and someone else is doing something. So we're doing that all the time as a constant. I would say it's still a bit trendy, middle class. There's still the walled garden in Perthshire that wants to grow herbs. I don't have terribly much patience with that. And there's not enough from the housing schemes of the East End of Glasgow. There isn't enough because culturally it doesn't exist. So culturally, well-off people take to social enterprise? See, I don't want there to be, I want there to be lots and lots and lots of small ones. I want the social enterprise in Birdie House to be the Birdie House Social Development Trust, which runs its own, it knows its own area, you see. Now, unlike us in Wester Hills, we should have got connected out the way we didn't, but I would ask Birdie House to get connected. Say, look, it's none of our business, but I can tell you three people that do it better than you. What do you mean? I'll give you the names of three people in Scotland who are doing what you're doing, but they're doing it better. What do you mean better? Well, they're making more profit, they're serving more people. Really, in the social enterprise world, I wouldn't charge you to copy what I'm doing. You come, copy anything I'm doing, I'll help you set up in your area. The idea that I go into your area and recycle your waste, your waste's an asset for your community. What am I coming and stealing it from you for? So I would say, well, this is what we do, and we gather the glass together, we separate it into browning, and then we sell it on to them, but don't go to them, they'll give you a show. I'd pass that all on to you, do what you like with it. So it's a different ethic altogether, isn't it, really? It's open source, like, come and use anything you want, but pass it on. Mm-hmm. It's a contradiction of typical capitalism. You're saying, no, no, that's one way to run the world. Good luck, yes. But we're not doing it that way.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned previously that in the when you're working in Wester Hales, you're kind of answerable to the local council, but Senscot is much more answerable to kind of maybe the government on a national level or funded.
Yeah, well, I would like to say we're not answerable to anybody, but we are. Ultimately, central government. Our turnover last year just tipped over 500,000. 300,000 of that, 350, would come from central government. They're not grants. I mean, they're all contracts, technically. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not. I don't think they're tendered competitively. One or two of them are. But so we've no relationship. The individual networks have. They're not. People say Senscot's networks. They're not. They're all set up. They're very different. Some choose this legal format, some choose another. I think seven or eight of them are now legally incorporated, and they will have relationships with funders because they've all got workers. So Dumfries and Galloway Social Enterprise will have some network, will have some relationship with Dumfries and Galloway Council. Senscot, as far as I'm aware, has no relationship with any local authorities. Whereas the Edinburgh SEN, which is quite a successful one, Leslie, and the Glasgow is very successful, they will interface with the local authority. But, I mean, we have nothing to do with that. I'm glad to say they all get together regularly and share experiences. But see, we don't impose. We say, look, our guidance says, no, not even guidance. We've got no relationship formally with them. So what we advocate is that you've got to be a social enterprise. You don't have local government officers on your network. But I mean, how will they feel? I don't really care how they feel. They're not social enterprises. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a wee bit, you know. They're very helpful to us. It's up to you. So most of the SENs will not have anything but social enterprises on them.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that perhaps social enterprise today isn't getting to the same kinds of people as you managed to involve in the community enterprises in Wester Hales. How do you think it could go a wee bit further and get to those people? I mean, I suppose I'm making an assumption here that those people still exist, but would you agree with me that there's still a need to get to people who are unemployed or...
I would agree with you, but let's look at this. Sorry. The ability to say, I can be self-employed, I can conceive of something. I mean, I'm working with a young woman just now, she's 30 odd, and she's got all the skills and the ability to set up her own charity, doing the work that she does, but she's working for someone else who's frustrating her. I said, well, I mean, what are you waiting on? And if I try to analyse what it is that prevents her taking the leap to set up her own thing, that's what we're talking about just now here. Is it a confidence ultimately? And if I took her hand and said, for the first year, I will mirror you, I will, every question you have, if you want to talk about what format you should be, we'll talk about that. If you want to talk about So, the ability to set up your own thing is much more middle class because of the confidence, good school, private school, blah, blah, blah. All your peers are lawyers or professional people. If you come from a housing estate, employment's not very stable in your household, how are you going to go and set up a social enterprise? Which is, you're not, are you? But occasionally, see, what I've advocated to First Sport is that you should have talent spotters. It could be different people in different areas. In Muirhouse, there was a very alert priest, Father McAllister, probably dead now. I would have said to Father McAllister, right, Father, every year I want you to find three people here. Bright sparks, youngsters, we're trying it. They've got imagination, they've got a wee bit bottle, right. So these people exist, but like the woman I was just describing to you, this young woman, they just need a wee push at that early stage to get them started.
Do you remember a specific person who you've kind of formed that kind of relationship with?
I hope there were many over the years. Just to sort of keep the conversation going, though, I've also made the mistake of projecting onto a person what I wanted them to be, and what I hoped or imagined they could be. And therefore I've pushed people into a failure situation because of my own persuasiveness. I wouldn't do that as readily now. I would still err on the side of pushing too hard. I think I would. Because I've experienced how much liberation there is in being your own boss. When I'm speaking to youngsters and family, I say, follow your own bliss. Find something in life that you really love doing. And then for the rest of your life, your work will be a pleasure. And I still feel that very, very strongly.
And so do you think that's the best way that social enterprise can help people?
No, I got wandered off social enterprise there when I was saying that just now. There's no doubt that the Senscot annual Cayley and conference, 150 people, there's a spirit of people enjoying what they're doing. There's no doubt about it. You've got And you see conversations round tables really animated. So you've got, in social enterprise, you've got, I mean, the wages are not good. I don't want them to get good. But people have got the tremendous satisfaction from their work. People that argue that third sector wages should be the same, why shouldn't they be the same as the private sector? Because we get a huge compensation from what we do. We get great joy. And I have no pension, I've got a state pension, I have no assets, this is a rented house. But I have a great pleasure in my life from my work. Still do. And some people will not be able to make that decision or so. You shouldn't be judgmental about it. Some people will go for the safe. I sit with my own family and what did young Michael do? Well, he's working for a firm of consultants in London. Big bucks. Does he like it? Hates it. So what deal has he made with life? Hates it. I got to know when we set up Scotland Unlimited, I got to know that we were chaired by Jeremy Oppenheim, who was a partner with McKinsey's. I got to know him quite well. He said, we cream the brightest graduates from the best universities, and keeping them is difficult. One of our most potent tools is pro bono work. We offer them a wee juicy cherry now and again. So-and-so is looking for a pro bono work. And whereas they go to this firm that's already making a lot of money and they help them to make more money and they do that again and they get a bonus. Pro bono work is just they're doing it to help somebody out and they really find that very satisfying. The girl that worked with us, Bernadette, she went to Brazil and she's working with kids who live on the slum heaps in Brazil. That's from McKinsey's. So what is it I'm saying here? It's just as powerful a human motivation to get involved for the public good as it is to make money. It's just as strong. If it wasn't just as strong, we'd have blown each other up. I think we would have.
And so I'm interested in this relationship between social enterprise and the market, and social enterprise and kind of state services. How does social enterprise position itself? Is it trying to replicate state services? Is it trying to replicate, you know, a market function? Where does it fit? Or where should it fit ideally for you?
I'm trying to question myself if I understand your question. I'm not sure if, Gillian, I fully understand what you're asking there. Try and help me a wee bit more.
So should a good social enterprise, should it seek to replace a state service?
Oh, speaking personally?
Yes.
Well, I'm a social democrat and I believe that we should have public services of a high quality. I can see a role for the market too in the society, my ideal society, but I'm not really very keen, to be honest with you. People are critical of Senscor's bulletin because it's a little bit too hard on the private sector. But I don't really have much time.
I get where you're coming from completely. And so do you think the goals of social enterprise, have they changed over time, with the kinds of initiatives that you see springing up? Do you think they're trying to address different social problems than previously? Or are they always trying to address the same thing?
You're talking as if social enterprise was something fixed and definable. It isn't really. It's a very vague. You've got the code, that's, I suppose, a very purist, it's a kind of benchmark, an idealised asset locked. So when you ask that question, are you talking about Scotland? In Scotland, has social enterprise, as we use the term, changed the type of things which it's addressing?
I mean, are people interested in addressing unemployment? Are people interested in improving housing? Are people interested in improving childcare facilities? Has the focus of people's energies in social enterprise, that, you know,
yes,
changed?
Under, just below the radar, there's a huge interest just now in alternative food projects. Everyday growing food, distributing food, food banks. There will be hundreds that have grown up in the last couple of years at grassroots level. The numbers of sports organisations that are trying to move into social enterprise, hundreds. Every day on our website. I've been given your name, we're a so-and-so. Excuse me. you've asked a specific question. That culture as well. People are going into it. People are trying to find a way to become sustainable in the new world. Hope I'm not going to give you what I've got. Have you had it this year? Does that answer your question?
Yes, and I think what I'm interested in is, you know, you mentioned that I'm maybe thinking about social enterprises as too set a thing. I think that's interesting, and I think you're probably right. And so where does this, you kind of all these organisations coming to you, where are they picking up, you know, their motivations? You know, you mentioned food and food banks and things being a popular one just now. Where are they getting that energy from? Is it because of a need that they see in their community, or is it a personal interest? How are we seeing this relationship between people's motivations and what they choose to focus on?
Well, let's just take, there've always been all these arts and crafts groups. There's always been all these sports clubs. The trend out, the vibe out there is, become a social enterprise and you'll be sustainable. Where did that come from? Where does it's not come, it's not past. This is current, what I'm saying to you. Where is that coming from? This spreading consciousness that their field can become sustainable through a kind of social enterprise. What is a social enterprise? Can you imagine them at parties all over the country? What is it? Well, it's kind of, you run it like a business. So that consciousness is growing, I would say, out there. We see a lot, recently, a lot of people that want to grow food. The so-and-so food growing group. Dozens. Now, nothing else comes to my mind at the moment of particularly strong, bubbling. It's an interesting question, you're quite right. Is social enterprise something? Is it something tangible, definable? All the mapping attempts, Sensgo has been linked to most of them. We've never had much enthusiasm for it. We've never initiated one. Incidentally, we're coordinating a social enterprise strategy group. Jonathan Coburn from the Social Value Lab is writing it. I was speaking to him yesterday. What would I put in a social enterprise strategy for today, for 10 years forward? What will it be? So that's going on at the moment. It's just of interest to you. He'll do a draft before Christmas, he said. a social enterprise something which you can map? Don't think so, really. I mean, where does it sort of... A preschool playgroup, you know, that's a social enterprise. I mean, is a brownie cub group a social enterprise? Why not? Not trading, well, so near Bob or Joe. So you've got... It's very difficult to get a hold of what it is. So Westerhale's people opening a chip shop, that's fairly clear. You know what I mean? But so many things tail in and tail out of. So you come out with five criteria, you need to be trading, you need to have a social purpose. You know, it's called a voluntary code of practice because you know when you're writing it that it's kind of vague. It's not anything very defined. So, I mean, in your position, archiving the history of the social enterprise, you know, John Pierce's book, Social Enterprise in Any Town, he more than anyone has written the history of it, how where it evolved from, the roots of the... I mean, I personally, I'm not drawn much to theory and forms and pie charts. I'm not really, I don't think they capture much of reality. But it's important that somebody does try and do that. Otherwise, we're all talking forever vaguely, aren't we? Yes.
I think that's interesting in itself, though. You mentioned that social enterprise kind of fades in and fades out. Would you say that a successful social enterprise needs to be a long-lived thing? Or can a successful social enterprise be a very, you know, short-lived thing that just exists for a moment and then dies down, but it's fulfilled a specific need? You know, how do we balance...
Grants, you see, social enterprise grants. This chap wants to set a memorial, just like in the field. Some battle took place, 30 people got killed or something. So he wants a memorial to that battle in this field behind his house. I said, but that's not a social enterprise, I said. Well, why not? I said, for heaven's sake, he wants to build a cairn in a field behind his house. So I lost the argument, he got the grant, why shouldn't it be a short-term thing? I mean, with respect, you're trying to define something that's... You're trying to afford a definition to something that's not. So this woman, Chi, she's a shadow minister for social enterprise. She says she's going to define social enterprise. If Labour win the election, she's going to define social enterprise for the purpose of grants. She's not. I mean, her officials are going to tell her, no, don't go there, aren't they?
I've just only got two more questions for you. The first one is political support for social enterprise a help or a hindrance?
My first reaction is it's a help, definitely. I must have something in my throat. I've not eaten anything. Politicians are always going to use you. And so you're trying to use them. So you know the name of the game. So far we've used them more than they've used us. I would say that's my personal critique of what's happened. John Swinney has got a great ride out of social enterprise, but he's been very, very helpful to us. When the schools of Scotland had some kind of competition to who's the best, They gave prizes to something like 15, 20 schools. And John Swinney stood on that stage for 35 minutes. And he gave them all a plaque framed, and he got a photograph with these kids patiently. So he has been explicitly identified with social enterprise. It's helped his image. He's looked after our back. And he was the guy in charge of the till. He was financial secretary, still is. So we've had good funding. Scotland's got an exceptionally well-developed infrastructure for social enterprise. We've had many visitors in the last year, Sweden, Norway, whatever. They've all been amazed at the support for social enterprise in Scotland.
And why do you think that is? How is this
being able to... It's your first question. Has political support been plus or negative? It's been plus.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Everything we've thought of, they've funded. No, there's been a few they've said no to. In fact, Jonathan Coburn asked me yesterday, he said, some people are saying to me there's too much intermediary support. I said, you mean like Sosenska? He said, well, not specifically, but yes. I said, yes, there is too much. I would like to see stuff out there in helping people that have not got our skills. I'd like to talent spot people that have never had a prize in their life, never had a grant in their life. Just a few hundred quid to get them started. That could have a tremendous effect. But that needs people out there, you see. But you can't be, so you need someone in these housing estates that works there, who you trust. And he'll phone you up now and again, oh, I've found the right one here. It's a wee girl called so-and-so. And we would have someone to send out and work with that girl for a few weeks.
So my last question is, are you optimistic about the future of social enterprise?
Very quick answer, yes, I'm very optimistic. I think it's a very powerful idea that fits with the time we're living in. My grand view of the world is that we sort of swing. During my lifetime, the last 30 years especially, since Thatcherism really, you're talking since the 1970s, there's been a real swing towards money is king, money rules. I've seen it in my own family. And I think it's going to drift back. And I think social enterprise fits into that drift back. I honestly think, so I'm optimistic that, now what should social enterprise do to be taken a bit more seriously? So the problem is I don't want Bernardo's big organisations with fundraisers getting thousands of pounds. I want lots of wee things. The woman that opens the church hall in Morden, Betty, who's 82. I mean, the vast majority of the third sector organisations are small, no staff, all volunteers. So if we become too serious, social enterprise, you're on the risk of Betty becoming scrapped for something efficient. I'm a great advocate of local democracy, but I don't want it to replace voluntarism. I want it to be voluntary. I think that's the real core of society. In Wester Hales, the neighbourhood strategy, 22 different neighbourhood councils. We went round every door, folk came out, they went to the meetings. There weren't very enlightened discussions in the early days. Most people didn't speak, but they were out there. I want to tap into that. So if social enterprise, SE, becomes mainstream. They've got all these professional chancers who are majored in social enterprise. I don't know how, but I'd like to cling to this kind of amateurish side of it. Because I think professionalising stuff moves it away from people. So the wee girl that's been spotted in Muirhouse by the local priest or whoever, she's potentially anything. She just doesn't know it yet. And so if we can spot her and have somebody that's trained to talk with her, and I'd like to, so the new generation, I'd like that to be, I'd like the new generation to be taken care of. Now that can't be planned in central government offices. It's not your normal business support systems we're talking about, men in suits going about the place. That's no good for that girl.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of person, what kind of role does that girl need? Who does she, who needs to be in place to help her?
Well, we had a Pat Bowie, we had this, going back quite a few years, with the Senscot Exchange. You phone up and you get Pat, you say, I've heard you'll help me, I'm trying to set up a sort of, yes, that's what I'm here for. How are you? What have you done? What are you trying to do? And that was very, very successful. So that little girl needs somebody who has got her culture, understands her culture, is completely at home and relaxed in her culture, can walk into the local cafe, if there is one, but is also completely relaxed in the culture of Cooper's Lybrand. Now there are such people. The growth of our sector depends on this architect who's made enough money turning towards us and saying, I can help you out. So, well, if you could, we need somebody to spec up some work without charging us. I'm your man, what is it you want? We want concepts for this. We're trying to put a building there. Now, the feasibility money would cost you thousands, but if professional people that are okay are willing to face towards that and help out, and that's what we did in Wester Hills. I mean, every profession we could call on.
So does social enterprise need social mobility in order to...
Social mobility?
Yeah. Does it need to draw on people who are, you know, working class and have been able to, you know, gain professional skills to kind of go back?
Oh yeah, they're paying back, yeah. Well, that's the... Social mobility means to me someone who has started off pretty lowly in life and got... And you're saying such people are often willing to come back. They are. They are. When I've said to people, look, Bob, I'm really grateful to you for this, but why are you doing this? Well, you don't know my story, do you? I says, no, I don't. Do you want to hear it? I says, yeah, I'd love to hear it. And then they tell you the harrowing story of being poor and where they grew up. And I mean, that is burned into them. Now, some people walk away from that and try never to think about it again. And others, okay, I'm okay now. I don't have to cling on to the wall. I'm going to go back and help a wee bit. Some folk do it. But there's a huge amount of goodwill out there. There's a huge amount of goodwill. It's just there to be tapped. They're not daft. They're looking around for someone they can trust, believe in. And it's a great help that you've not personally become rich off what you do, because people look at that. I mean, the idea that you drive up in a Barber on a Land Rover, I mean, what? You're joking. you ask very good questions. I'm not quite sure if I've thought a lot of them through. The last question was, am I optimistic about it? Yes, I think it fits. I think it fits well.
I've covered everything that I'd like to talk about. That was really helpful for me to have that discussion, but is there anything you think I've missed out? You know, I'm aware that I am a novice in this field compared to yourself.
Well, no, you've surprised me by spending as much time looking into the crystal ball as to where it's going, as you have been trying to record the history of the development of it. I mean, it's been a much more personal discussion, which I enjoy, than I would have anticipated. I have no memory for when we did what. I don't know why, I just don't have that kind of memory. But I've enjoyed chatting with you. Have you missed anything out? No, I think it's great. Will social enterprise, there's no such thing as social. Will this idea that people increasingly trade for social purposes, will it get bigger? Yes, it will. Just from what I'm looking at. Privately, I don't think that this special, the purist model that we advocate, I don't think that'll endure. Because you're asking people to be poor. Not poor, but you're asking them not to be wealthy. Now in America, they don't even ask that question. A social entrepreneur in America is someone who's made his pile, Bill Gates, and is now going to cure the world of malaria. Oh, God. But we're not as bad as America, but there's a wee bit of that, especially in England. Scotland's very different, the culture of social enterprise in England. They've got much more contaminated by these American outfits at Oxford, various other places, Schwab, Ashoka. They've come across with the American culture, which is that rich people own everything. In Scotland, there must have been Jimmy Reid and the Clydeside, and before that, Keir Hardie, Wheatley. There's a tremendous tradition of... I saw black people in America who were defeated in a way that white people are not defeated in Britain. In Scotland, anyway, I've seen poor people that have got great pride and dignity. And I saw black people when I visited America. I'd never, of course, slavery, you know, the history of slavery. What must that do to you? So the American assumption that everyone in the world wants to be wealthy does not, it's spreading in Scotland, but it's not finished us off yet. Now I think the social enterprise ethic, the kind of, no, I get a good salary and I enjoy what I do. That's enough for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It's enough for a lot of people.
I'm happy to stop the recording there, if that's all right with you.